Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
The Michael Reed Show Podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Friday morning, the 13th of January. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reed on LMFM.
As we all know, we are in a very important time, a very important week where progress needs to be made on the issue of the protocol, on getting the executive back up and running, getting the assembly into action, and ensuring that people have government, that we have leadership here in the north of Ireland.
An important week indeed that started with great hope for all of those reasons.
We had hoped to, with others, make progress on those issues at today's leaders' meeting. I travelled for that meeting because I believe that it is an important meeting.
That's the Sinn Féin president speaking on Wednesday. Mary Lou MacDonald had travelled to Belfast to head up the Sinn Féin delegation, but
rather than having that kind of meeting, a kind of British Tory petulance has emerged.
Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin, locked out of talks between political leaders with the British government. A bizarre situation, she said.
And in an unprecedented way, the British government chose to seek to exclude the leader of Sinn Féin from a leaders' meeting.
A hopeful start to the week, but that hope undermined by what all political parties here in the South agree should not have resulted in the British excluding one of the party's leaders.
It has to be said, unacceptable. We're at a time where we need maximum cooperation. We need politics that is civil, that is based on respect, and that recognises the democratic mandate and the responsibility of every party, including Sinn Féin.
And John O'Dowd, Sinn Féin MLA for Upper Ban, joins us now. We'll talk about where all of this is going in a moment, John. But can we start with how your party president was excluded from those talks? Because Geoffrey Donaldson has said this morning that those talks are internal talks in Northern Ireland. And because Michelle O'Neill is the Sinn Féin leader in Northern Ireland, it's Michelle O'Neill who should head up the Sinn Féin delegation at those talks. What's your reaction to that?
Mary Lou MacDonald is the leader of Sinn Féin across the 32 counties of Ireland. Michelle O'Neill is the vice president of Sinn Féin across the 32 counties of Ireland. And the British government are aware of that. She's aware of that. I mean, Geoffrey has engaged with Mary Lou on many occasions in the recognition that Mary Lou is the leader of the party across the island of Ireland. So I think attempts by the British government to rewrite the rule book in terms of how discussions and engagements take place is a huge mistake. It was created a distraction. It did prevent what could have been a useful engagement between all the political parties and the British government, and kept the momentum going within what the talks between the British government and the EU. So
it looked like we were getting over that, though, didn't it? And it seems as though Geoffrey Donaldson is stoking the fire again this morning.
Well, I don't know what Geoffrey's agenda is and what he's attempting to do, but Geoffrey knows fine well that Mary Lou MacDonald will be continuing to lead Sinn Féin in terms of any engagements. Michelle O'Neill, as deputy leader of the party, will continue to lead Sinn Féin in terms of those engagements. And Sinn Féin will decide who attends talks at what time, when, or who is attending those talks. So it's all a distraction. What we need to do is get the engagements going. The British government and the EU need to step up their engagements around, particularly the British government needs to come to the table with a working proposals, a working relationship with the EU to try and get over this. But there's nothing to stop the DUP and Geoffrey forming an executive with Sinn Féin and the other political parties today, tomorrow, and getting the real issues that are affecting people here, health, cost of living, and it helped to start resolving those issues and those huge challenges we as a society face.
Okay, Geoffrey Donaldson and the DUP would say it's the Northern Ireland Protocol that's stopping them from doing exactly that, but there is hope on the horizon in terms of the British government, at least.
Yes, but the local political parties here are not involved in the negotiations between the British government and the EU. And those negotiations will continue whether there's an executive or not. So if Geoffrey's intent was to collapse the institutions to either start the pace of or the agenda of those negotiations, that has clearly failed. But we can resolve, and there's issues around the protocol which need resolved, but there is jobs being maintained and created in the north as a result of the protocol. Our economy is being bolstered as a result of the protocol, and there are businesses growing in the north as a result of the protocol. So let's not paint a picture. I'm not suggesting you are, but there's certainly an attempt by the Democratic Unionist parties and others that the protocol is bad.
Yeah, well, so bad. They see it as bad, and I think that they probably believe it as bad, not for the reasons that you just went through there, but because of national identity. But when it comes to the approach that's been taken by the DUP, it probably has failed, because it does seem as though the British government or the Tories are going to sell out the DUP once again. James Cleverly is to meet with Maris Sefcovic again on Monday, and reports this week that the negotiating teams on the British side and on the European side could be going into the tunnel, as they call it, this sphere where talks take place and nothing is said outside of those talks.
I don't know what the outcome of the talks will be, but I think you can guarantee that the Tories will act in their own self-interest, and that will not be to the assistance of unionism and will not be the assistance of nationalism. It will be to the Tories' own self-interest. But these talks, while the subject is the protocol, the real heart of these talks between the British government and the EU is the British government re-establishing its relationship with the EU. Because during the Boris Johnson era, and the brief interlude of Liz Truss's here, the relationship with the EU was severely damaged, as was the image of the British government on the international stage. So what the British government is now trying to do is re-establish a working relationship with the EU for the benefit of the British government. The protocol is a side story to it all. And the people who are suffering as a result then are the constituents in Geoffrey's constituency and my constituency, who are facing huge challenges, whether it be around heating, living, cost of living, accessing healthcare, and stabilising the political scenario here. So those talks will continue, not in the interest of anybody who lives here, in the interest of a British government whose economy is in serious difficulty, and they need to establish a working relationship with the EU to help their economy through what it's going through at the moment.
And it seems as though there is the prospect of a face-saving exercise for the British government, and they'll do a deal. But that doesn't mean that Northern Ireland is going to leave the European Union in the same way as the rest of the United Kingdom, does it?
Well, I would hope that the EU negotiators have now recognised the importance of the principles of the protocol, and that the relationships on the island of Ireland are framed under the Good Friday Agreement. I still believe the British government haven't got their heads around that yet, but I do believe that the EU have do understand, and in fairness, the Irish government understands the relationship across these islands, the importance of the Good Friday Agreement, and the importance of all Ireland trade to the economy across the entire island, and the prospects that the protocol brings here. Now, the protocol hasn't been fully exploited in terms of its potential to create jobs and sustain businesses.
But for the reason, the exact reason I outlined to you a second ago, that Northern Ireland is leaving the European Union in a way that's different to the rest of the United Kingdom, and therein lies that question of identity and the problem that the DUP and others have with it.
All of this was explained to the DUP when they supported Brexit, and they didn't only support Brexit, they wanted the hardest possible form of Brexit. When Theresa May many years ago announced that they were leaving the single European market and the customs union, I and others pointed out to unionism that that was going to cause huge problems on the island of Ireland, and we were ignored. So time and time again, the DUP has failed to work along with their neighbours here on the island of Ireland. Rather, they were attracted by the bright lights of London and worked with the Tory party and the right wing of the Tory party around Brexit until, once again, they were let down. The protocol had to be introduced because the EU, the United States and others recognised the importance of the Good Friday Agreement, recognised the relationships on the island of Ireland, and recognised that the all-Ireland economy is crucial for the well-being of all the people who live on the island of Ireland.
Yeah, it's a pity that politics wasn't simply a question of winning logical arguments, and I'm sure you've won that argument with all of our listeners this morning, logically, but this is politics. Northern Ireland didn't have a government last February. It's certainly not going to have a government this February. Do you think that James Cleverly is going to call an election on Thursday of next week?
Well, we remain optimistic and realistic. There is potential, and as I repeatedly say this, we can form an executive tomorrow. There's nothing to stop us forming an executive tomorrow. Though the DUP continue to block it up. There may be an announcement from the EU British government talks. They may bring forward a proposal, and then it's up to the DUP to decide whether they're going back in or not. And that will be the real test for the DUP, because many people believe that while there are concerns around the protocol, the real issue for the DUP is that there's going to be a Sinn Féin First Minister, and they can't bring themselves to share power with a Sinn Féin First Minister. So when the deal between the British government and the EU is announced, that's the big test for the DUP. Are they prepared to honour the outcome of an election, the outworkings of the Good Friday Agreement, and are they prepared to work and share power with the rest of us who live in this part of the
Which, area. Of course, is completely illogical, because we're talking about optics here. The office of First Minister and Deputy First Minister are of equal importance. So it makes absolutely no difference. But because of the titles, the DUP will be concerned that they'll be seen to be subservient.
Well, certainly, we have no intentions of making anyone subservient. They may have that view themselves. But the reality is that the verdict of the electorate has been that Sinn Féin is now the largest party, therefore entitled to occupy the office of First Minister. And in that joint office, as you say, the joint office of First and Deputy First Minister. So that's a question only the DUP will be able to answer once the British government and the EU do their deal, which I hope is sooner rather than later. And so all the excuses are removed. Okay. And we can get back to running government, and we can appoint a health minister to help deal with the health crisis. We can appoint an economy minister to promote the protocol and create jobs, sustain businesses, and create prosperity.
Do you believe, though, that will happen, or do you believe that an election will be called on the 19th, or that will be pushed back, and whether there is an election at all, that there will be a government in situ come the 10th of April, the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement?
Well, under the previous legislation, should have been an election call in October. The British government changed the rule book again, and it's up to the Secretary of State as to whether he calls an election. But I think that this idea that we can continually bypass the electorate is damaging for democracy. The people are not simply bystanders and observers to this, they're participants. And if the DUP continue to refuse to enter an executive, then there should be an election. And the people should have their say on the continued DUP boycott of those institutions. I'm, as I said earlier, we are optimistic but realistic. There can and should be fully working institutions of the Great Friday Agreement by the 10th of April, not simply to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Great Friday Agreement, but to put in place the mechanisms of government, which, while there's huge challenges ahead for the next executive, they're there to betterment for the betterment of the lives of the people we all serve.
Okay, until the DUP ends its boycott, British rule continues, or rule from Westminster continues. How long can that endure?
It can't. It's an affront to the principles of the Good Friday Agreement. And if the DUP continue to sidestep or boycott or whatever term we want to use in terms of responsibilities, then there's an obligation on the British Irish government to, through the Intergovernmental Conference, to bring in structures which have the ability to govern this place under the principles of the Good Friday Agreement. But no one wants to reach that stage. We want to share power with our unionist neighbours, with those who are non-aligned or whatever description people want to give to themselves. We want to share power, and there's an ability to share power here for the betterment of all the people. So there are options under the Good Friday Agreement, but the optimum option is the restoration of the institutions. There is an onus on the British government to engage seriously with the EU and bring forward an agreement, a deal, whatever terminology you want to use. But it's going to be, I can't believe it's the protocol, too, or whatever you want to call it, but the principles of the protocol will remain, or have to remain, to ensure the continued smooth running of trade across the island of Ireland.
And when will Sinn Féin call for action? I put it to you that deal looks very likely, and it looks equally likely that the DUP is continue to remain in this locked-in position that it has adopted, and that it's not going to take its seats on the basis of the protocol, and, as you say, because it doesn't want to recognise the Sinn Féin First Minister. At what stage does Sinn Féin say the Good Friday Agreement is not working? The Good Friday Agreement is not working in practice unless there is power sharing.
Well, I don't think it's a case of the Good Friday Agreement not working. Over various periods of those last 25 years, there has been those people. It has to be remembered, the DUP never, ever endorsed the Friday Agreement, stood against it, campaigned against it, and have never endorsed it. They have been reluctant partners in government over a period of time. And throughout the period of those last 25 years, whether it's in the guise of the British government, whether it's in the guise of anti-agreement unionism or those who call themselves dissident republicans, there's been attempts to dismantle the Good Friday Agreement. And because of determination between the political parties at times, the two governments, all those attempts have failed. So let's make sure this attempt to undermine the Good Friday Agreement fails as well. And let's do something that hasn't been fully tried over a sustained period of time. Implement the Good Friday Agreement in full, and work through the Good Friday Agreement in its fullest terms.
The same question remains. I'm not sure if you want to put a time limit on how long you're going to accept the situation.
No, I don't think we should put time limits on it. I think that would be a mistake. But there is an opportunity now for the British government to bring to an end to bring to a conclusion, it would be a better way of putting it, bring to a conclusion the talks between the EU and the British government. There's an opportunity there. The messing should stop, and hopefully that messing has. The Boris Johnson era of diplomacy, the Liz Truss era of diplomacy has hopefully come to an end, and the British government are sitting around the table as a serious, sensible, honest government engaging with the EU. If they're doing that, then those discussions can come to an end very quickly. The outcome of those discussions should be announced, and then the true intent of the DUP will be revealed, and people can decide then whether it was the protocol, whether it was Sinn Féin First Minister, whether it was an inability to accept that they're now facing an island and in transition. All those things and some of those are all, in one way or another, are legitimate concerns. I'm not dismissing them. All of that, but I'm dismissing the concern around the Sinn Féin First Minister. That's a bad outcome. But they are they're concerned of unionism, which one way or another have to be dealt with, have to be engaged with, have to be understood. But there's none of them have the ability or the strength to stop government being formed.
Okay, well, an important week ahead of us next week again as those talks between the British government and the EU continue, and hopefully there is light at the end of the tunnel, to go into that so-called tunnel, and there'll be light at the end of it. We'll leave it there for the moment, though, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Much appreciated. That's John O'Dowd, Sinn Féin MLA for Upper Ban.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, thanks to you if you've been in touch with us this week. I have to say it's been one of those weeks that I don't like, where an awful lot of comments came to us and we didn't have enough time on the programme to read out all of those comments, and we're going to try to make amends today and come back to those comments. We do read all of the comments and we try to incorporate your thoughts into all of the interviews and make your points known, because we hope that all of the interviews are reflective of all of the points that we can think of. So when you send in comments, then that gives us something to think about, and we try to incorporate it into the interviews. And thanks to everybody who's been in touch. But as I say, we've made a lot of time on the programme today for comments, not just the ones that came to us earlier in the week that we hadn't time to come to, but also in the hope that we get some today. So if you'd like to comment, our telephone number is 041 983 2000. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael at lmfm.ie. now, we started the week off this week by talking about the 100X bus service to the airport. It goes into Dublin City Centre, but it's a very important bus, obviously, because it serves the airport, goes from Dundalk through Drogheda onto the airport and then into the city centre, and it's an abysmal service. It's always half an hour late, and we discuss how bad it is and why is it diabolical, and why can Busera not put on a bus service and run the buses on time in line with the timetable. We got a lot of calls about that, I have to say, and a lot of calls about the 100X, but not just about the 100X. We had somebody in touch with us saying, you're talking about the 100X, but you'd want to be waiting on the town bus. It could be 30 minutes late, or it mightn't come at all in Drogheda. And thanks to the caller for that. Betty Doyle was in touch with us as well when we were talking about the buses, about the 102 that serves Baldoyle, Portmarnock and Malahide to the airport, and it misses at least half a dozen times a day, she says. And then we had Gavin in Blackrock in touch with us saying that he was listening to that and he had a suggestion about the 168. That's that new service that goes from Drogheda to Clogherhead. Why can't it go into Black Rock? Maybe go in at Sexton's Pub down at the Main Street and then out at Greengate. So it would only take 10 minutes, said Gavin in his message, which I thought was very interesting as well, because Gavin wasn't the only person talking about the 168. The Mayor of Drogheda, Michelle Hall, issued a press release this week, disappointed at why the bus is always late, never on time. What is it about the buses in this country? And I was almost afraid to mention it again today in case somebody else called in with another service that is not on time. But sure, why not? Let's gather up all of the complaints, make a list and send them on into Bus Éireann and see if it results in any improvement. I'm not saying it will. I'm not sure it will. I don't even think it will. But it might be an interesting exercise if you want to tell us about your bus service if you're not happy about it. Now, Damien English has resigned, as you know, as a Minister of State. Paddy Duffy was in touch with us yesterday saying, for Christ's sake, that man was in housing and planning in the 2016 to 20 government. I think it was for a year between 16 and 17 that he had a junior ministry in housing. Thank you indeed for that, Paddy. We'll be talking about that in some detail in a moment. Another call that came to us about Damien English was from Robbie, who said, well, Michael, another morning of these so-called TDs in and out of government giving out all these TDs do is moan. Another listener said Damien English is a good minister. Shame to see him go. But somebody else said, why are these people allowed to remain in their jobs when they do something like this? Would you be kept in your job if you did something wrong? Don't ask that question. There's an awful lot of people who say I do wrong every day. But thank you indeed for that. Billy in touch saying, like Kaleri, There's a name we haven't heard for a while. And the rest, he'll be back in no time in the trough. Integrity me are, said Billy. Thanks for that, Billy, and the very strong language. Well, Damien English continues to be a TD, of course, and there's no change there. He's just lost his job as Minister of State. Another text from somebody about that who said, why does Damien English not resign as a TD as well? If he's not fit to hold office as a minister, how is it he's suitable to hold office as a TD? It's bullshit. Will the house have to be demolished now as it wasn't subject to proper planning? The rules have to be the same for everyone. It's so blatantly obvious that there are special rules for the privileged elected who are in government. Thank you indeed. Some very strong thoughts that came to us about that. And everybody's been talking about Damien English over the last couple of days, including the Tánaiste. Is it? Micheál Martin used to be the Taoiseach and he's the Tánaiste and he's been talking about Damien English.
I think he took the right decision in light of the issue that had arisen. Albeit 14 years ago, I think he made his decision himself, from what I understand, and he came to the Tánaiste or to the Taoiseach and indicated the situation. I think it's very difficult personally for him. I think he's been a good minister and he's been a good parliamentarian. I've known him for quite a number of years. He engages, he's very active, and I think it's a very difficult day for him and his family. But I think he made the right decision in the wider sense, given what transpired.
That's Micheál Martin. I was embarrassed there for a second, not being able to remember if he was the Taoiseach or the Tánaiste until I heard him a little bit mixed up there himself. So when did the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, hear about this from the Tánaiste, Leo Varadkar? No, sorry, I've done it again, haven't I? I've done it again. Let me just recheck that now. Yeah, so when did the Tánaiste, Micheál Martin, hear about this from the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar?
About 20 past 12 last evening, the Taoiseach. Look, we all got used to this, apologies. And we've been doing very well up to now. But the Taoiseach contacted me to let me know what had happened and that Damien English had contacted him, spoken to him, and had offered his resignation, which the Taoiseach accepted. So, I think that there is an obligation on politicians, you know, in terms of issues like this to in terms of declarations and so on, to make that very clear.
Right. That's Micheál Martin speaking about the resignation of Damien English. And I suppose to be safe, all we'll say is Micheál Martin is a very important person.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Yeah, just on that subject of Damien English resigning as a Minister of State, he's giving up a job worth €141,657 a year, plus expenses, of course. Don't be too concerned for Mr. English because he'll continue as a TD, a job which commands a salary of €105,271. Let's speak to our political correspondent, Sean Defoe. A very good morning to you, Sean, and thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. Do you believe that Damien English will continue as a TD?
I think he probably will. Certainly all the indications from both the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste yesterday is that they're not going to seek any further sanction, and even the initial reaction from Mary Lou McDonald's while saying this did the right thing and stepping down and there needs to be perfect scrutiny of government politicians wasn't going any further than, you know, to call for his resignation as a deputy, because that had come into question yesterday. There were a lot of people asking, well, look, if this is the behaviour unbecoming of a minister, and a minister who served in the Department of Housing for 4 years, no less, why is it not unbecoming behaviour of a TD as well? He misled the council on the property holdings that he had when he submitted his application, and the result might have been different had he not done that. And I'm sure there are probably people listening and maybe texting into you, certainly people across the country who have played fair game in the planning system and have had planning permissions, particularly in rural Ireland, refused as a result, who'd say, well, if there's one standard for one, why is there one standard for the other? But both the Tánaiste and the Taoiseach were asked yesterday, do they believe that Damien English should step down as a TD? And both effectively said no, that he had paid the political price now by resigning as a minister, and that's sort of where they leave it. Leo Varadkar very much just trying to kick for touch with this, saying that it would be up to Meath County Council or the local authority involved basically to commence any sort of investigation if they wanted to. Now, from what I understand, they can't do that because of the statute of limitations, but that's what he said. Eventually, after being pressed several times through questions, Varadkar said he would seek legal advice on whether any law was broken here. in actually misleading. He said he didn't know offhand whether it was, because he's not an expert in planning law, but he would look for that. But you suspect it is not something he's going to pursue with a great deal of vigour.
Okay, you said you think Damien English misled Meath County Council. We haven't heard from Damien English since his resignation other than that video on Twitter. And it seems to be the case that either he misled Meath County Council or he had forgotten that he was the owner of this particular house that he omitted from his application.
Yeah, and look, as you say, we haven't heard from him yet as to the more details, or all that he said was that the form wasn't correct when he filled it out, non-review, and that he admitted that and that it should have been correct. It wasn't up to the standards of someone who holds office, and of course went to the Taoiseach to say that he felt his own position was untenable, which would sort of lead you to believe that maybe it is the former that he did in fact mislead the council on it.
It's impossible to think that he had forgotten that he owned a house, isn't it?
I mean, look, it's very hard to think, you remember buying a house. We all remember buying our first house. He's one in his name at that stage. It's not something that you forget, even if perhaps you were living with his parents. I don't know the circumstances of what the living arrangements were at that time, so I'm not going to go and...
And that is another question that the minister is going to have to answer, this question about how long he and his family spent living with his parents.
And living in that home, what they're doing with the home now, and whether or not it's vacant or not, because of course remember the first story that came out around this was in relation to SIPO declarations and the fact that the property hadn't been declared on his SIPO returns. So what he said in response to that was that the property was in family use, not in any other use, and not in certainly commercial uses, and it wasn't being rented out, or he wasn't providing an income for it, which would mean it was exempt from the SIPO declarations. But look, there's an awful lot of questions here that weren't necessarily addressed in Damien English's first statement, and I think are still going to have to be addressed, because there is a wider question for the government now over how its TDs handle their housing affairs. This is the second minister to go in the space of 6 months, Robert Troy obviously being the first. Both of those revelations made in the Ditch website after they went back through their different housing records, and certainly at a time when so many people are struggling to get housing, are struggling to get on the housing ladder, and are understandably angry at the government, to see this sort of repeated, at best, lackadaisical attitude towards their housing affairs is kind of galling for people.
Yeah, well, I can understand people who don't have somewhere to live or are finding it difficult to stay in their accommodation, wondering how a property could be left lying vacant for so long, or if the minister actually forgot, the former minister actually forgot that he had that house, or what had happened. Is it a case of him being caught red-handed? And if the statute of limitations didn't apply, if Meath County Council was able to question this legally, in a circumstance like that where you'd wrongly filled out the application form for your new house, is it possible that the new house would have been demolished?
This is one of those questions that comes up a lot when you get into planning law, because of course you see it's not an uncommon occurrence that things get built without planning, usually extensions to different homes, and there is a facility then where people can apply for retention after the fact, and you do get people finding that maybe it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission in a case where they don't think they can get it. That's a fairly common feature of the planning system. You get into this case then, but I don't necessarily think it serves anyone by demolishing it after the fact, particularly when we're in the midst of a housing crisis. But it is a very open question. If you build something without planning permission that wasn't there to be built, should it be taken back? I think it sort of exposes a bit of a hole in our planning law that's been there for a long time, totally unrelated to Damien English, that certainly needs to be addressed. And one that, to play the counterpoint on it as well, a lot of people in rural Ireland find the planning rules around one-off housing incredibly frustrating. There's a lot of people who have not been able to build in the place where they're from, be it in the field next to the family home, a field they might have got from parents on a farm, or for example, haven't been able to get their planning permissions. And maybe where their frustration with this case will come back in is they played by the book and didn't get their permissions, where it looks like Damien English didn't play by the book and did get what he wanted.
Okay, and made the application under that exemption, which would allow housing to be built for local needs because he's from the locality, but wouldn't have qualified because he already had an existing house. But because he omitted that, was able to go ahead and build this house. A lot of people will be very interested to hear what the minister has to say about all of this when he does eventually make a public appearance and make some public comment on it. It's Neil Richmond, I think, who's being tipped to replace him at this stage, is it?
Seems to be the favourite. The two names that I'm hearing are Fine Gael, Neil Richmond and Joe Clary. They were both names that were thrown around when there was the cabinet reshuffle less than a month ago, really, a reshuffle of the junior ministers. I suppose Richmond is seen as something of a rising force within the party, had been very strong with their European affairs spokesman and got a call indeed from the Taoiseach to tell him that he wasn't being appointed, such as the theme that he sort of holds him in. And usually people who are overlooked don't get that sort of courtesy. So certainly he would be the favourite. But then others thinking about maybe geography and Fine Gael needing a bit more of a presence in the west of Ireland, looking at someone like Joe Clary, who's been a DD for sort of 20 years, I would imagine the promotion of Kieran O'Donnell from Limerick might be a mark against Joe Clary, because, you know, they have that geographic thing sorted. So Neil Richmond is certainly the favourite, but we should know potentially by the end of the week, if not very early next week. Senior ministerial appointments do require cabinet approval, so it might be one they save till next Wednesday when cabinet is.
Right, I imagine whoever it is will be asked to reassure the Taoiseach that everything is ordered, that they've declared all of their interests and they're in line with ethics legislation. But there's not going to be an audit of cabinet ministers or indeed junior ministers for that matter, let alone all TDs in the House.
No, definitely not. And this was something that was asked yesterday. They're not going to audit, sort of expect that. And I think the Taoiseach said it rightly, you know, they expect TDs to be on top of their own affairs and to be reviewing their own affairs and to act with a certain degree of ethics and decorum when they are going about their business. But it's one that's kind of coming up again and again. You know, there was a pledge that Fine Gael made their TD sign, or made their candidates ahead of an election sign, in the wake of the whole Maria Bailey affair, to basically say that there are no skeletons in the closet when you run for election for the party. Since then, obviously, we've had the issues around Robert Troy. We had the whole Gulfgate scenario. So more ministers resigning, and now Damien English as well. So how do you go and audit your ministers and say, come here, is there anything else in the closet here? I don't think they're exactly going to be throwing the hands up lest it be found out. But I imagine all ministers will be, and all TDs even, will be looking to their affairs and going, God, is there anything else that may come out here about me?
Okay, well, I'm sure our listeners will let us know if they have any questions for the minister as well. We hope that he will have some time in his schedule available to speak to LMFM next week. But thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Sean Defoe was our political correspondent.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
By the way, thanks to the WhatsApper. Is that a word, a WhatsApper? thank you if you were the person who sent us in a WhatsApp message to say that the 167 bus Dundalk to Mullingar is a top class service. Great. Glad to hear that. Glad to hear about bus services, whether they're good or otherwise, for that matter. Do let us know. A number of people in touch with us this morning about the resignation of Damien English as a Minister of State, saying they're all incompetent in the Dáil. Is this another Leo? That's John in Navan. Thank you indeed for that, John. Paddy Duffy says, the definition of ethics: moral principles that govern a person's behaviour or the conducting of an activity. So ask yourself if Damien English has behaved ethically. All right, we'll read it again, Paddy. I take it you got this out of a dictionary. The definition of ethics: moral principles that govern a person's behaviour or the conducting of an activity. Did Damien English live up to that definition, I think, is what Paddy Duffy is asking all of us to ask ourselves. John, thank you for your message. He says, what about all of the houses that don't have planning permission at all? They never had it. And there's many of them as well in Damien's local area, says John. Desi is in Balbriggan and he says, I wonder would Damien English ever have had, suddenly remembered he had made a false declaration if the website Ditch did not bring it to the attention of the public. I can't answer that. There's only one person, I think, who can answer that. But thanks, Desi, for asking that question. It's a very interesting question and one that we hope to be able to ask the former minister at some stage. Another text comes to us from a Navan listener who says, Michael, it seems Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are content to allow someone who has not been honest in making a planning application, in other words, Damien English, to stay on in politics, to remain in Fine Gael, to remain on the government backbenches.
Hopefully those who voted for him in the past won't make the same mistake again. How did he get away with this for 8 years, says our Navin listener. Thank you again for asking that question. And they're all very pertinent questions, and it's great to be getting them. Damien English is a local TD. We hope that he'll be speaking to his local radio station next week. Can understand that the minister, former minister, has gone to ground.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And isn't speaking to us today or yesterday or anybody else for that matter, despite our repeated requests to Damien English to discuss this issue with us on the programme. Maybe next week. I don't know. I can't speak because we've no indication one way or another. I did say that we're trying to catch up on calls, and we're also asking you to call us because we've had so many calls this week that we didn't allow time for them, not expecting so many calls to come. So we're allowing a lot of time on the programme today for comments. And if you want to add to what's been said, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 041 983 2000. That's 041 983 2000. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. That's 086 1800 658 if you want to send us a text message, or email michael@lmfm.ie. Now, one of the big talking points on our phone lines this week has been the control of dogs, roaming dogs, dogs attacking sheep, worrying sheep, killing sheep, and indeed people. And that little boy in Kildare, wasn't it? Wexford, sorry, in Enniscorthy. And we had a lot of calls to the programme yesterday about that. We were speaking with Michael Fitzmaurice, TD, on the programme about this yesterday. Paddy was one of the people in touch with us, and Paddy says it's not just big dogs that we need to legislate for. Any dog can turn vicious. That's what Michael Fitzmaurice was saying, and it is an interesting point. I suppose what we're wondering is if the so-called dangerous breeds, who are more dangerous apparently than the other breeds, will be barred or banned altogether, which was what the Taoiseach seemed to be implying a couple of months ago. But Paddy says all dogs can turn vicious, and he says he knows a young boy who had a dog. The boy adored this dog, and he used to go everywhere with him. Then one day, the dog turned around out of nowhere and attacked the boy. We all need to be careful of dogs, he says. Good advice, Paddy. Thank you for that. Philip tells us he reported a vicious dog to the guards, but the owner is still out walking the dog, no muzzle on it. So what are you supposed to do in cases like this when you follow the rules but no action is taken? Thanks for that, Philip. I'm surprised the guards didn't direct you to the county council. I think it's the dog warden that you would ordinarily be reporting dogs to. And I think, ordinarily speaking, the dog wardens are very receptive when they get a call from the public who have concerns about dogs. Thank you for that as well, Philip. Some other calls that came to us about dogs on the programme yesterday. Somebody said we have two dogs wearing collars, and we have one of these wires all around the house trying to keep them in. But over the last 3 days, we've had to chase sheep out of our yard due to a heedless farmer. Where would we stand if our dogs attacked the sheep who came in? God, that's the second time this week. I don't know if that's Marie, I can't remember, but from Dunsany, who told us she'd about 50 sheep, 30 to 50 sheep in her garden in Dunsany. But if not, it's the second time we're hearing this week of sheep roaming into somebody's garden. I don't know. I would imagine that would be the farmer's fault, and nobody could blame you if your dogs attacked sheep on your land, especially when they're locked up like that, kept in with the wire. Somebody else saying, I can't understand why these people have big dogs. Why do they need these big dogs? Why have the dogs in houses with children? If they're big dogs. That's Tom and Kells. Thanks, Tom. Another text from somebody who says, Michael, there's a group and the amount of dogs on it missing is so disgusting. They should never own a dog. They have a terrible attitude. You treat a dog like a child. You care for them and make sure that they're under control. The owners are morons. I see it on my walks every day. Another text then from somebody who says that there's been a lot of sheep kills and they go unnoticed. They're not reported, and there could be people who have motivation for allowing this to happen, and they're encouraging their dogs to attack sheep. Mick and Kel says there are two dogs that I would trust, a dead dog and a dog with no teeth. Thank you indeed, Mick. I did laugh at that when I read that yesterday as well. There are just some of the calls that we got on dog control this week. That's one of the subjects, and some very interesting calls, I hope you agree. And I think it's worth giving the time over to make up for the last time that we had on the programme this week. All right, as I say, we're hoping to hear from as many people as possible today. If you'd like to make comment on the programme, we would love to hear from you. I called yesterday, a text yesterday from somebody who says, why don't you open up your phone lines for members of the public to ring into the show, and then we could hear their views, ordinary people's views on things. Thank you indeed for that text message. Our phone lines are open. If you want to come on to the programme, you're more than welcome to come on to the programme. We might ask you what it is you want to say and make sure that you're not going to libel anybody or get us into trouble or anything like that. But we'd love to do exactly that. People can be a little bit hesitant about coming on the radio, and I think I can understand why. But if you want to come on to the programme, you're more than welcome. And indeed, we're going to hear from somebody who called into the programme yesterday in just a few minutes' time.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Another text message that has come to us this morning, following on from some of the interviews we did with new residents in Termonfeckan, who are now living in the triple house, from a local person, somebody who lives in Termonfeckan, I take it, says, very good and informative visit yesterday to the triple house. Thank you for putting local people's minds at ease. There's been a lot of upset in Termonfeckan over the course of the last week, and our programme dispelled a lot of that fear because nobody had been forthcoming up to yesterday with reassurance when the men there were already assessed by the appropriate measures, leaving people's fears to run riot on an internet page. I hope they all settle in well now, says this local person in Termonfeckan. Got to tell you, actually, I was in Termonfeckan again yesterday. I called out for a different reason, a very, very positive reason, which I'm hoping to be able to share with you in the coming days. Hopefully next week I'll be able to bring this news to you, and won't go into it now. But I was there for that reason. But when I was there, I saw a local person who had also dropped into the triple house after hearing the radio programme yesterday with golf clubs. I think it was just one golf club and a few balls and one of these little holes. If you're a golfer, you'll know the type of steel things that you can practice putt into as a hole. Oh my God, you'd want to see the fellas. My God, this was something for them to do. And a ring board so that they could play rings. Imagine, you know, because they're sitting there and they've absolutely nothing to do. They're hearing about some ill feeling as well. They were delighted to see some local people come in and visit them. The local people afterwards told me they were delighted that they went in. They felt an awful lot better after speaking to the chaps in there. They're all just ordinary blokes who are a long, long way from home with nothing to do and are hoping for something to do. I saw somebody bring in some clothes. My God, they were very interested to see if they could get a change of clothes as well. It's just a little bit about the condition of people who have fled from terrible situations from all corners of the world, not just from Ukraine, but from all corners of the world. They've come here seeking international protection from terrible, terrible things. We've had a lot of discussion on the programme this week about it. And as I've been saying, we're trying to make up on some of the comments that came to us during the week by bringing them to you today. We didn't get time to do it during the week. And we had that call earlier, that text I read to you earlier from somebody saying, why don't you bring callers on the air? People who are listening to the programme, if they ring in, why don't you bring them on? Let us hear them. Well, Carrie was on the phone to us yesterday. Carrie is in studio, actually, after calling us yesterday because we called her and said, do you want to come on the programme? She said, yeah, sure, I'll drop in. And we said, we'll have the kettle on.
Literally brought the caller in.
Well, thanks for coming in to us, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
And you're very interested in this attitude, or the different attitudes, probably more accurately put, towards immigrants in this country these days.
Well, yes, I suppose you could hear from my accent that I'm an immigrant myself.
Have you been vetted?
No, actually, no, I've never been vetted. But I am an Irish citizen. I did obtain my Irish citizenship decades ago. I've been here 23 years. I have two children that are born and raised in Ireland. And my daughter's going to Trinity. And, you know, I'm very proud, actually, to be in Ireland, to be Irish. I love this country. And I come from America, and my heart has been broken over what's happened to my country in the last decade. And I am heart scared of it happening here in
Ireland. You're drawing parallels between what you've seen happen in the United States with the rise of the right wing and what is beginning to happen here now.
Yes, because it's not an isolated rise. These people work together. They are funded together. They are part of the same movement, the global far right. The people in Ireland were meeting with the people that were just arrested in Germany for far right activities.
That's right. One of these groups had invited one of these known Nazis who tried to overthrow the German government.
Yes.
That person is now in jail. They were in Dublin not so long ago addressing a meeting of one of those
groups. Yes. Nigel Farage, Herman Kelly, good buddies. Herman Kelly trying to recreate Brexit here. Daft idea, but there you go. Steve Bannon. They're all tied together. They're all funded from the same pool. They're all drawing from the same well of hatred, division, and destruction. And
same pool as Donald Trump.
Yes. And the most important pool they're drawing from is grift. They want money and they want power, and they'll sell you anything to get it. And they have found that hate and anger and division makes them a lot of money.
And they make reasonable arguments, don't they? You know, I mean, that's the way it appears on the face of it. I mean, when you hear some of these groups, and I'm not talking about any of the individuals you named there, I'm not talking about anybody specifically, but there are a number of groups who make arguments against immigrants. And the first thing they say is, we're not against genuine refugees.
Well, that's your first clue that they are. It's like Maya Angelou used to say, I don't want to offend you, but, well, if you don't want to offend me,
stop right there.
Exactly. You know, and you can apply that same logic to, I'm not racist, but, well, actually, you're about to be racist. So you are. Yes, they piggyback on a lot of arguments or, you know, plausible scenarios. It's insidious. It's designed to get you to go, well, that makes sense. And then that leads you to thinking the next thing makes sense.
Where would you get it? You couldn't make it up. These are turns of phrases that are used all the time.
Yeah.
And they're appealing to your logic and to your common sense to look at something and say, well, right, maybe they do have an argument.
Well, they're appealing to your emotion. And I actually was talking to my son the other day about this because, you know, he listens to Joe Rogan and that leads to other interesting characters.
That's a big internet.
Yeah, it's very popular with teenagers, teenage boys, and I'm trying to teach him to think critically. And one of the main things is if you have an emotional reaction to what you're seeing online or what you're reading, that is a good indicator that what you're seeing is propaganda. Mm. If it makes you angry, if it makes you upset, if it really gets you going, that's propaganda.
If it makes you think, I hope nobody thinks I'm stupid.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be the approach where they say, you couldn't make it up. Where would you get this? Who'd believe this?
Yes.
And you're going, I did actually believe it up to a few minutes ago, but now I'm not going to be that stupid.
Yeah, if it divides you into an us and a them, and you want to be part of the us because you don't want to be isolated, you don't want to be made fun of, whatever, that's propaganda.
Did you see yesterday that one member of one of these groups tried to burn down or will threaten to burn down a hotel?
Yes.
And the residents in it.
Yes.
Under the banner of Ireland for the Irish, Ireland is full, Irish lives matter. This is a new one I saw this morning. And the Irish flag, the national flag, the tricolour.
So let's destroy Irish jobs and Irish livelihoods and Irish people that are working in these places, as well as the immigrants.
Let's kill them.
Yeah, let's kill them. Well, it's not the first time that they have firebombed facilities with immigrants in them. And that also needs to be highlighted far more. These are dangerous people. And those of us that were in town on the Saturday that they showed up noticed that the men that were at the fringes, you know, I'm concerned about the safety in this area.
Just back up a little bit, because you're talking about what happened in Drogheda last Saturday.
Yes.
And we did, I was speaking with Lucky Cambule on Wednesday's programme, I think it was, one of the days during the week, and we heard some of the chants from a counter-protest, racist scum off our streets. You were one of the people who participated in that counter-protest. There was a protest against the refugees in Drogheda.
Yes, I felt extremely strongly that it was important and my duty as a citizen that lives here to stand up, even if I was the only person there with my little wee sign, just to show that this was not acceptable by everybody. These people do not speak for me. You know, I thought it was really important to be down there. And I was glad that there were a lot of other people that also
there were a lot of youngsters down there. I was really, really encouraged by the amount of young people I saw.
Yes, fair play to those teenagers.
Yeah.
They were wonderful and it gives you hope for the future. And funny enough, they're still, the Irish Freedom Party people are still kind of smarting over the humiliation that they suffered in Drogheda. And one of them was mentioning the other night that young people were yelling at the old men and women, you know, and kind of doesn't get it that they are representing something that is a relic, you know, and that's why they're full of old men and women that are getting yelled at by the youth of today who are absolutely rejecting it. You know, racism and that kind of thinking, that kind of division and hate has no place in contemporary Ireland, thankfully. You know, and Ireland is a remarkable country. Mm. We have it so good here. And a lot of times, I think, with all of the negativity over the problems that we do have that do need to be addressed, but we kind of forget that this is a really good place to be. We have a small democracy that functions very well. Mm. We have services and security and peace. Mm. And never underestimate the value of the peace and the stability that we have in this nation. And it's worth fighting to protect it.
Incidentally, just I asked you a few moments ago when you sat down, are you vetted? because the reason I asked you that, it was half tongue in cheek, but it's one of the things that we hear all of the time. Are these people vetted? I just would like to suggest to all of our listeners this morning, the next time somebody says that, ask them if they'd like to reveal their past, if they've ever been charged with anything, if they've ever been prosecuted for anything, if they've ever spent any time in prison. Because I think you'll find that some of the people, because I've found that some of the people who are asking, who are these people coming over here and they're not vetted? That a lot of them have criminal backgrounds.
Where are your papers? That's what that question is.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where it's coming from too, historically.
Yeah.
But on the vetting question, this is where thinking critically comes in. Because if you think critically about that, when they say, are these people that are being housed in the refugee centers vetted, how do they think that those people are placed there because they have been processed and vetted? You know, maybe not traditional quote-unquote Garda vetted in the way that volunteers for organizations would know it, but they have been processed through the system, and the government and the people running these centers know exactly who is who and where they are. So it's a ridiculous question on the face of it when you deconstruct it and think critically.
It's not perfect, though.
No, the whole thing is a shambles.
The war in Ukraine.
Horrible.
The idea that 70,000 people come into this country within the space of a year is ridiculous in actual fact. It's a huge challenge.
It's a tactic, too, deliberately done by the Russians in order to put pressure on Europe to break the alliance.
But the point is, it is putting pressure on Europe, and it is putting pressure on this country, as are the other asylum seekers and the amount of people who are seeking protection in this country. It is not perfect. It's not perfect either for large groups of men to be provided with accommodation in one setting. Term of fact, a good example, small village, small sleepy village, 42 men arrive and it's understandable that people have questions. And I don't know, I can't speak for you, but I think it's only right and reasonable that people have questions and they ask those questions and that those questions are addressed as best they can and that the situation is improved, not just for the people in those places, but for the men themselves or the men and women who come here.
Well, surely, as a mother, one of the ways that I would look at it is how would I want my son to be treated were he needed to flee? To another country for whatever reason, you know, or he just ended up on the shores of somewhere far away. How would I want my son to be treated? That would be one question I would
ask.
I'd
be surprised if I'm wrong, but I think most of the mothers listening to us this morning would tell you that if they were in Ukraine, for example, and just one example, or Afghanistan, any of these places, would they want their young men who we'd all call boys, but they're men in the eyes of the law because they're seen as adults. But do we want our young boys to stay and fight and die, or do we want to get them out of here?
Oh, yeah, we want to get them out of here. We want to protect our children. We want them to have a good life. We want them to have a better life than what we have. So, and a lot of times what you do, especially say if you're an older person and you have a young, healthy son, you send him out because he is capable of surviving that. And then, your hope is that he will lead the way for you. And I know the Irish know that. I know they know that from experience. And it's still in living memory, you know, that's what was done. So the first question that I would have is, how would I want my son to be treated? And then the second question is, yes, they're all reasonable. You know, how is this being conducted? It is a shambles the way that the government's handling it.
It's an emergency, though.
They get some leeway because it is unprecedented numbers. They weren't prepared for it. And, you know, they're doing hopefully the best that they can. Could they do it better? Absolutely.
And hopefully in time they will. You know, hopefully this is a temporary situation.
Yes.
And a better solution will be found in time.
Yes, because living in, you know, what looks like the huts of Longkesh on the Donor Road, it's not a permanent situation.
Yeah, or sleeping in tents.
No.
Or on the streets.
No.
There's 14,000 people in hotels. The hotels are not going to continue with that situation when we get into March and April.
And ultimately, if people are going to stay in this country, you want them to integrate into the country. You don't want to have a segregated society, and you don't want Ireland to fragment into different little communities. Everybody should be integrating together. You know,
but when you don't know who's there and, you know, they're out of sight, but not out of mind, because they've suddenly arrived into your neighbourhood, you're hearing Chinese whispers, and one thing leads to another. Somebody's stoking it up on the internet, telling you that somebody's come from somewhere that instead of going to prison or being locked up in a guard cell because they stabbed somebody, they'd be moved in there secretly. You start to wonder. By the way, I just want to tell you, Kerry, that Jerry Brady in Clongill Wilkinson says that lady you're talking to is a breath of fresh air, and I'm delighted to have the chance to listen to her this morning. Thanks for that, Jared. But I wanted to ask you about that exact scenario that I outlined a moment ago. It was wonderful to see some locals in Termonfeck and yesterday go in with golf clubs and mm-hmm. ring boards and clothes and, mm-hmm. and walk out feeling very differently than they did a few days ago.
Yeah.
And thought, God, these are our new neighbours and they're nice guys. We had a text that came into us yesterday. I thought it was one of the best suggestions I've ever heard anywhere from a listener who said, whenever this happens, there should be a meet and greet organised. That the community should be invited to a place to meet with the new residents and take the fear and the mystique and all of these things that people are afraid of out of it. What do you think of that?
I think that'd be great. I think that there should be a welcoming committee organised, and that should be not just there to as a one-off welcoming committee. And I know that there's communities around Ireland that are doing this, where there is a group of people that are working together, working with the new arrivals, teaching them how to access what they need to access, where things are, how the society works, and you know, bringing everybody together to integrate. And I think what would be a great idea, Drogheda is great for festivals.
Mm.
Why don't we have a cultural festival
that
involves the refugees, that involves the immigrants that are already here? We have a large immigrant community in Drogheda. You know, wouldn't that be great if, like, every summer we had an international festival in Drogheda that celebrated all the people that are here?
Mm.
You know, and working together to create this is a way that we could integrate and get to know each other and treat each other as the neighbours that we are.
Okay, so long as they don't want to vet me. I mean it. No, it might sound funny, but I'm not joking. Listen, I'm going to have to go to a break and all of that. Is there anything else you want to say to us before?
Just thank you very much. Part of why I ended up here today is because what you're doing and highlighting this and speaking honestly about it, calling things what they are, and then going out and getting the information from the actual sources, whether they're the refugees themselves or the people running the centers or government figures, is so important, because on the internet there's a free run by these people who half of them are trolls and bots and don't even exist in the first place. It's so important what you're doing, and I want to thank you very much. Thank you
indeed for your call and for accepting your invitation to come onto the program and then taking all the bother to come in and see us. And thank
no
you
bother
indeed.
Thank you
and lovely to meet you. Thank you indeed. That is Kerry McIntyre. Now, if you'd like to make comment on the program, as always, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 0419832000. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael at lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, John in Navan texting us this morning saying, Mike, was Damien English and his missus so desperate for a house that they had to lie about not owning one already? That's an interesting way to put it. It's the way the Irish Independent is putting it, by the way, John. They're describing it as a lie. It was either a lie or an oversight, or they forgot that they owned a house that they owned, or they ticked a box without realising they had ticked the box, because it asks you very specifically that question, and they would have declared that they didn't have another house. So that's one of the questions I'm sure that the minister will answer, and I'm sure that it won't turn out to be a lie, but thanks for that. Paddy Duffy in touch with us saying there's only one race on this planet, that's the human race. And he also asked us yesterday, would you consider naming and shaming these far right wing persons, or words to that effect? He said it would be useful to the rest of us. There's a problem, Paddy, when you name them. They demand a right to reply, unlike the internet, because we're regulated and there's rules and laws and things like that, and that we have to be fair to everybody. You get a right to reply if you name somebody. And then they sue you. And then and it takes an awful lot of time. They sue you unsuccessfully, but you have to spend an awful lot of time with lawyers and filling out legal form, and really, it's just too much bother, Paddy. Maybe we should go on the internet and name and shame people and do it in a way where there's no regulations and all that kind of thing, and you can make up things and tell lies. But I'm not sure that that's what people want. But thank you indeed, as always, for your message to the programme. We'd another text this morning then about dogs. There it should be how the job of the Gardaí, if you have a dog, it doesn't have to be a Rottweiler or a German Shepherd, they do the job of Gardaí. They deter intruders, says our listeners, our listener, I beg your pardon. And yes, the bigger the dog, the more you deter criminals or would-be criminals. A dog is generally made wicked. As you know, most robberies are opportunistic and any animal can bite. Even a horse will bite or kick you if you're not careful. Does that mean that we ban them as well? Thank you indeed for that and for your text to the programme today. Some other messages from our listeners that came in over the course of the week. Somebody in touch saying Michael Fitzmaurice, who spoke about dogs, should be on the should stay in politics for as long as he can. Comes across with such empathy and gives people a belief in democracy. Thank you, Margaret, a regular texter of the programme. It's great to be catching up on these messages, and we'll give more time on the programme to messages if we get more messages. And that's the problem. You find sometimes that you leave time in the programme for messages and you don't get the calls. But thank you to everybody who's been in touch with us this week. Keep it in mind today. Keep it in mind on Monday and all of next week and into the future. We would love to hear from you. Our telephone number, it really makes it all the more interesting to be getting all of these different opinions. Our telephone number is 041 983 2000. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658 or email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
If you've ever wondered why there's a homeless problem, you've probably asked yourself, why don't people just rent somewhere to live? I mean, you can get rent allowance or housing assistance or whatever it's called these days if you're unemployed, and the government will pay for your rent. Well, there's an answer to that which comes to us today once again from the Simon Communities. In December, there were 757 properties available to rent at any price. This is from the Simon Communities Locked Out of the Market report. But out of the 757 properties that were advertised, just 41 of them came under what you would receive under the housing assistance payment. Let's speak now to Wayne Stanley, who's the executive director of the Simon Communities. And a very good morning to you, Wayne, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme. It's even worse than that, isn't it? When you think of the 41 places that were available to rent to HAP tenants out of the 757, 40 of the 41 were discretionary HAP tenants.
Yeah, so if you were to look at the sort of the basic rate of HAP, I think there was only one property. There was only, in fact, one property available within that, and then there was an additional 40 if the local authorities were to avail of the full discretion that's available to them. And in the Dublin region, that's an increase of 50%. And outside of Dublin, it's an increase of up to 35%. So really, what we're looking at here is really what we're looking at is a private rental market that isn't available to people who are at risk of or experiencing homelessness, or indeed beyond that, isn't really available to people on low incomes unless they have the capacity to top up that that payment. And that is why we're still seeing some move on into the private rental market, where people are kind of stretching themselves. But we have real concerns that that isn't sustainable, because people on low incomes can't afford to be paying an additional couple of hundred euros a month on top of the rent, the sort of contribution they make to the rent to the local authority.
Okay, for the purpose of your report, you've looked at what was available in Cork, in Dublin, Kildare, Leitrim, Limerick, Sligo, Portlaoise, Waterford and Dundalk, which is local to us. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what was available to people in Dundalk.
So in Dundalk, when we looked at it, there was only, at any price, there was 16 properties, and within a discretionary half limit, there was 6 properties in total over the 3 days. So really what you're looking at here is, I think what we probably described as a functional zero, really. We're looking at a situation where, you know, when you break that down, when you look at people presenting with a housing assistance payment, when you look at the number of people experiencing homelessness who may be trying to avail of that property, there really are very few options. And we're starting to see that as well reflected in the national figures for the number of people accessing a HAP payment, which is starting to actually decrease nationally. It's still a very important resource that's there for people on low incomes. There's still 49,000, in excess of 49,000 households who are getting housing assistance payments, and that's helping them to maintain their home in the private rental market. Yeah. So, but I think what the real learning is that when we started doing the locked-out reports some years ago, we were really looking at what was available to people on this payment in a private rental market and seeking to monitor that and seeking to get government to make sure that people on a low income were able to compete in the private rental market if that was going to be an option for them. I think what our report is now showing is that, you know, HAP rates are not about affordability anymore. It's about sort of buying people into the market, and we can't continue to chase rents. And also the market itself is becoming so tight that it's really not a viable option for the vast majority of people who are on low incomes, for the vast majority of people, particularly that the Simon communities are concerned about, who are at risk of or experiencing homelessness as a mechanism to keep themselves out of homelessness or to support them to get out of homelessness.
Okay,
means we really need the local authorities to step up.
Okay, I was going to ask you what I thought was an impossible question. I think you were just about to answer it there, because what I was going to say is that if there were just 41 properties available to rent and 11,500 people homeless in the country, all of those people who are in emergency accommodation must think there is no hope, because you're competing with too many people for too few properties. And you said you don't want to chase rents. So I take it that means you're not suggesting increasing HAP payments, but what is the solution?
So I think the solution is what I think we've been calling for a long time. We need to look at how we can increase the public housing stock and make sure there's secure, affordable homes for people experiencing homelessness. So that means we need to look at innovations like modular build, which is the way that homes are built, you know, across the rest of Europe. And there's a sort of a fledgling or a industry in Ireland in that. And what happens in that, the homes are built, and in permanent homes we're talking about here now, are built in factories and then brought to site and can be erected in a day. And they can be put together in a factory in a couple of weeks. So we need to see that sort of innovation and technology developed by our local authorities and houses built on sites at scale. I think there's a further urgency here in that we currently have a moratorium on evictions, and that's a really welcome initiative by the government, brought about because of the scale of the homelessness crisis that we're now seeing and the fact that we're really at capacity across the country when it comes to emergency accommodation. So if we're going to see that ban on evictions lifted at the end of March, which is the current plan, we need to see action in the next 12 weeks. And really, the only option that's available in such a short period of time is to look at the stock of local authority housing that we have, look at the vacancy levels, look at allocation processes, and what can we divert to those people who are in or at imminent risk of homelessness to make sure that we drive down the numbers of people in homelessness, because simply we don't have capacity even to provide, or we're running out of capacity to even provide emergency accommodation at this point.
Okay, I'm sure you made those thoughts known at the housing conference in government buildings with the Taoiseach and the Minister this week. Are you encouraged by the approach that was taken by the government this week in reaching out to people for ideas?
I think it's always good to talk to people in the sector. I think in terms of what comes out of it, we'll wait to see what the details of any you know, sort of additionality to the Housing for All plan. And we do regularly engage with the Minister, obviously. But I think we're now at the point where sort of giving credit, although credit is due, I don't want to be harsh about it, but I think what we need now is to see results. We need to see the homeless figures start to come down. We need to see real action that's going to deliver secure, affordable homes for people across the country, particularly those who are suffering the trauma of homelessness.
Okay,
so
thank you.
That really needs to be done.
Thank you very much indeed. Wayne Stanley, Executive Director of the Simon Communities. That's our programme for today. Chris Murray was in the control tower. Maggie McGuire researched. I'm Michael, and God willing, we'll see you for our next programme Monday morning, 9 a.m. on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.